Welcome to the January 2009 edition of Groundwire. Groundwire is a project by the National Campus and Community Radio Association, providing grassroots coverage of local issues and progressive perspective on national and international news.
On this month's Groundwire, a shoe in the face is work two on the bush, conservative cuts, ICBC, what price Canadian gold, high school gays mount rally in the valley, and the open source software struggle. Stay tuned for these stories and more on Groundwire. But first, the headlines.
York University's teaching assistants, graduate assistants, and contract faculty, represented by QP Local 3903, have been on strike since November 6, 2008, and have effectively shut down all entrances to York's Keele and Glendon campuses. Teaching assistants and contract faculty are responsible for over 50% of the in-class teaching at York University, though represent only 7.5% of York's annual $848 million budget. QB 3903's demands have for the most part been met with a cold shoulder by York University's administration. The union's demands include job security for contract faculty, whose jobs are highly precarious, subsistence wages for teaching and graduate assistants with a guaranteed cost of living adjustment, and increasing the pool of funds for benefits to meet the 28% increase in graduate admission. At the commencement of the strike, York University suspended all graduate and undergraduate classes. Prior to the holiday break and striking in mid-December, York University's management refused to come to the bargaining table to negotiate a settlement with the union that would have brought students back into the classroom in the new year. During the holiday break, QP 3903's negotiation team was still hard at work and has sent management an updated package of demands in an effort to resolve this labor dispute before the end of the holidays. The fate of over 50,000 undergrad and 5,000 graduate students lies in the willingness of York University's management to return to the bargaining table. On last update, York University's bargaining team and the union's bargaining team are planning to meet January 3rd. For an update on the labor dispute, visit www.3903strike.ca. This is Ome Sama Rahamdullah reporting from CHRY in Toronto.
Vancouver weather was unusually cold and snowy for December. Temperatures reached minus 10 the night of a tragic fire in which a 47-year-old homeless woman known as Tracy burned to death trying to stay warm by lighting candles in her makeshift shelter. In the early morning of December 19th, Tracy had been contacted three times by police and outreach workers in an effort to get her into one of many homeless shelters operating during the unusually cold weather. She refused, however, as she would have had to leave her only belongings contained in a shopping cart. Ironically, the tragedy occurred one day before a no-barrier shelter allowing pets and shopping carts opened at 1435 Granville Street as part of Mayor Gregor Robertson's new homeless initiative. The initiative promises 348 year-round beds, 387 extreme weather beds, and another 115 that will open for 90 days this winter. This is Bea Bernhausen, CJSF FM.
The world's largest video game developer downsizes, affecting 1,000 employees. Just over 1 week after planning a brand new studio in downtown Vancouver, the Burnaby-based Electronic Arts has decided to shut down its already prominent Black Box studio, which has produced their most high-profile games in recent months. Eight other unannounced smaller development studios, also owned by EA, may also shut down. The main headquarters in Burnaby, BC, will still remain standing. According to a press release, EA's restructuring plan will save approximately $120 million annually, as well as another $55 million over the next few quarters. Approximately 10% of all staff, or 1,000 employees, will be let go. The 350 employees from Blackbox will be relocated to the Burnaby facility. Electronic Arts stock has dropped more than two-thirds of its value since the start of 2008.
Second-generation biofuel has successfully tested for aircrafts by Air New Zealand and is hailed as a new milestone in development of alternate fuels. Using a 50-50 mixture of standard jet fuel with synthetic fuel from Jatropha plant seed, a two-hour flight of a Boeing 747 has resulted in resounding success. Jatropha plant seeds are considered the best bet for biofuel development, as this poisonous bush has 40% oil content in its seeds. Jatropha seed fuel performs up to standards and may provide a way out for airlines suffering from high costs associated with jet fuel. The test flight was a joint venture between Air New Zealand, Boeing, Rolls-Royce, Honeywell Company, and Terrasen Energy. Air New Zealand issued a statement that they are attempting to become the first environmentally sustainable airline. Critics do warn that valuable farmland should not be turned into fuel cropland, but rather be kept as a source for food crops. Starbucks is at a losing end of a U.S. National Labor Relations Board ruling. It has found that three baristas were illegally fired after being identified as actively seeking to unionize their co-workers in Manhattan cafes. Starbucks was found to employ various tactics to squash any unionization of its employees, including issuing negative job evaluations to suspected union sympathizers, and has previously prohibited employees from discussing the subject of unionization in general. The judgment found Starbucks guilty of trampling on workers' rights to unionize, and this does not appear to be a case of a single cafe. Rather, it confirms that this multinational employer has a coordinated anti-union policy that is implemented nationwide across U.S. and potentially Canada as well. This is Irma Arcus, and you are listening to news.
Groundwire is a production of community radio stations across Canada, and each month we include a station report from a particular station. This month's report comes from CJSF, the campus community radio of Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, which has become a core member of something called the W2 Project. Here's Gavin Schaefer with more.
Vancouver's downtown east side is known as the poorest zip code in Canada, but despite the poverty, there is a strong legacy of community activism, one that is spawning a new media arts collective known as W2. W2 consists of various nonprofits, including art galleries, theater companies, print and online media groups, television stations, and two radio stations, CJSF and Vancouver Co-op Radio. W2 Executive Director Erwin Ustindi explains the idea behind the project.
W2 will be opening in the fall of 2009, and it's really unlike anything in Canada. A place where Downtown Eastside residents and residents from the whole city of Vancouver can come together in one space, have coffee, create art, do storytelling, see art, listen to conversations, and tell their own stories.
Simon Fraser University's Contemporary Arts Department is also relocating into the Woodwards redevelopment. W2 architect Gregory Henriquez believes the project will have an important impact on the community.
The arts are really the soul of the community. Without culture, there's no real spiritual dimension to people's existence. And so I think the arts at Woodwards is really being represented by W2 and also SFU Center for Contemporary Arts. And I think together they are going to be a meaningful institutional presence for the community and going to make this place very special.
Local artists and downtown Eastside residents such as Al Thatch are excited about the project.
I'm a musician who's been playing down here in the downtown Eastside for all 3 decades probably. And I think this W2 project is one of the best things that's ever happened down here. I can't wait to be part of it.
Once operational, CJSF Radio and Vancouver Co-op Radio will have a satellite station where volunteers and local residents can produce radio. More information on W2 can be found online at creativetechnology.org.
Our station report was edited by Bea Bernhausen and scripted by Charlotte Bourne. The audio clips came from a cell phone video produced by the Fearless Collective, a supporter of the W2 Project.
And finally, this month's features. George Bush's farewell visit to Iraq didn't quite go as planned. CKUT's Aaron Lakoff explains the Canadian response to the special goodbye the Iraqi people gave to the U.S. president.
On Saturday, December 20th, around 100 activists and independent journalists in Montreal gathered outside the United States consulate to bid farewell to George W. Bush in a fitting and deserving way. In an action entitled, "This is a Farewell Kiss, You Dog," the demonstrators threw shoes at a cardboard cutout of Bush in solidarity with Iraqi journalist Muntadhar al-Zaidi, who threw shoes at Bush in person at a press conference in Baghdad on December 14th. These are some of the sounds from that demonstration.
This is for weapons of mass destruction. This is for depleted uranium.
We'd like to invite any journalists who want to express their outrage to George Bush. Wait.
Hi guys, I'm Iraqi. And I waited for this moment for long. It's to give him
the shoe right on his face. Maybe Butler did it before me, but we have the chance now. I have two. I spared them for Mr. Bush. Next time, we should learn how to aim right into his face. We should not miss him next time. I'll try my best now to be exactly in his face.
After throwing shoes outside the U.S. consulate, demonstrators then marched over to a Canadian Armed Forces recruiting station near Concordia University and pelted shoes at an effigy of Stephen Harper, all the while denouncing the war in Afghanistan. The tone of the action might have been humorous at times, but demonstrators also wanted to highlight the severity of civilian casualties throughout the Middle East. While throwing his shoes, al-Zaidi also yelled at Bush in Arabic, "This is for the orphans and widows of Iraq." Al-Zaidi's actions transformed him into an overnight folk hero, and he inspired similar demonstrations in Toronto and cities throughout the world. This is Amar Sabi, a Canadian of Iraqi origin who took part in the demonstration in Montreal.
It's the moment that we, maybe most of the Iraqi waited for, to head to shoot or throw a shoe to the face of a war criminal. Bush is a real war criminal. That's why it's nice to see him thrown by a very dirty shoe. And in Iraq, we used to use this method to insult and show that we oppose you in a way. Maybe they didn't like it in the West, but this is the way. Before we throw the shoe on Saddam Hussein, now to the face of Mr. Bush.
And what about this action here today? How does this make you feel?
I think it's a message to all dictators and war criminals that one day you will get the shoe right in the face. So all the people, I think it's in the free world, they should now train how to aim the shoe right into the face and don't miss any war criminal again.
According to recent reports, al-Zaidi is still in custody in Iraq, and his brother claims that he has been beaten and tortured in jail. For Groundwire, this is CKUT's Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal.
Do you listen to any radio besides community radio?
Yeah, I like to listen to the CBC.
Well, if you like to listen to the CBC, listen to this feature by CJSF's Alicia Echelow.
On December 4th, spokesperson Ian Morrison from Friends of Canadian Broadcasting, a watchdog for Canadian TV and radio programming, alleged the Harper Conservative Party has a plan to slash a devastating $200 million from the CBC's parliamentary grant.
You could end CBC.ca and you'd save about $20 million. You could end Radio 2 and you'd save $12 to $15 million. You could close down radio and television stations in cities across the country like, you know, Vancouver, Calgary, Saskatoon, Edmonton, Halifax, etc., and turn CBC into more of a, in English, a Toronto Broadcasting Corporation, and in French, more of a Montreal Broadcasting Corporation. You could do all of those things, and you still wouldn't save $200 million.
In an interview with David Peterson on CIUT Toronto's Take 5, Morrison discusses a speech given by Harper.
I mean, what is it that the Conservatives have against the CBC?
I heard Mr. Harper give a speech a couple years ago. I was in the audience. It was a kind of a private occasion, but he made a number of nuanced remarks about it. I remember him saying, and this was partly in humor, I suppose, but he said, "Now, R.B. Bennett, he created the CBC, but we've long since forgiven him for that." And then later in his speech, he referred to a Toronto Star CBC journalistic mindset, and he joked about Canada being a country that spends public money on broadcasting. So there was a kind of a preoccupation with public broadcasting, which led me to conclude that it was very much on his mind.
Ian Morrison explains what some of the potential adverse outcomes to Canadian citizens may be from a $200 million CBC budget cut.
In over-the-air television during prime time, when most of us are free to watch, the amount of Canadian programming would go way down from where it is now. The role of CBC Radio as a fundamental cross-country linkage in Canada would go down. The east-west forces in this country would decline, and the north-south continental forces would rise. it was summed up by the late Grant Spry. He said, it's the state or the United States. And that's the force behind public broadcasting in Canada. If CBC were to go, Canada would not be that much further behind.
The Conservative government has already come under fire during the summer when it announced a $45 million cut to cultural funding. According to Morrison, the vast majority of Canadians like having a national broadcaster. If they still want to support it, they should let their government know.
Anybody who asked the CBC to save $200 million would be effectively trying, it would be the first step to closing it down.
You are listening to Groundwire. To reach us by email, send your feedback to groundwire@ncra.ca.
What's mine is mine, the saying goes, but does my mind undermine what's yours? Barrick Gold could be asking this question, as David Kosh reports.
On December 11th in Tanzania, thousands of villagers forcibly occupied a gold mine owned by the Barrick Gold Corporation. Barrick is the largest producer of gold in the world, and it is based in Canada. According to media reports, about 4,000 villagers overpowered security guards and then entered the mine, destroying about $7 million worth of mining equipment and stealing gold. About 800 riot police from the Field Force Unit were reportedly deployed that night to disperse the crowd with tear gas and guns. A Barrick spokesperson told Reuters News that police killed one person in the clash. Several people, including police officers, were reportedly wounded. The mine shut down operations for several days after the occupation. The North Mara gold mine is located in northern Tanzania, just south of the Kenyan border. According to sources involved with the North Mara community, the occupation occurred after security guards at the mine killed a young man identified as Mengwena Muita Mengwena. Evans Rubara is an investigative journalist and activist based in Tanzania.
When they shot Muita, then the villagers had to come and try to make their voice heard, because the government of Tanzania has not heard the voices of these people.
It is difficult to confirm the allegation that security guards killed Muita prior to the riot. An article attributed to the Tanzanian newspaper This Day suggested that he was shot by riot police after the occupation. Local village residents and police could not be contacted, and spokespersons for Barrick Gold in Toronto and Tanzania did not answer repeated requests for interviews. And Canadian diplomatic officials based in Tanzania were not available for comment. One thing seems clear. People in the North Mara area are angry. Here again is Evans Rubara.
And I've met the people in their localities suffering and saying that we do not want this company here. They tell you that this company rapes our country of our natural resources. This company causes our children not to go to school. This company has not done anything to actually make sure that the livelihood of the local people is improved.
Barrick would disagree. A report on the company's official website claims that it is, quote, committed to making a positive difference in the communities in which we live and work, end quote. It says that Barrick participates in sustainable development programs around the North Mara mine and provides decent work to its employees. But the charges against Barrick Gold are gravely serious. According to photojournalist Alan Lisner, who just returned from Tanzania, violence against local residents by mine security and police is not uncommon. Lisner noted that mine security guards have allegedly killed several people near the North Mara mine since 2005.
This wasn't the first time that there have been killings in the area. There have been about 7 killings in the area of people who were supposedly killed by mine security. And after many of these killings, there have been clashes where the villagers would storm into the mine site and shut down operations, just like they did recently.
Lisner noted that the construction of the North Mara mine displaced an estimated 10,000 people before Barrick acquired the property in 2006.
So when the big mining companies came in, the small-scale miners lost their livelihoods. Many of the farmers lost their livelihoods because their lands were taken or polluted by the chemicals from the mine. So thousands of people there have lost their livelihoods in the area, so there's lots of unemployment. Most of the jobs that have been provided by the company itself are jobs that require a certain level of education, so most of the employees are migrants from other parts of the country. So when you have that many people who have no sources of income in the area, then then you're asking for trouble, really.
According to Tanzanian lawyer and activist Tundu Lissu, Barrick is transporting tear gas and hand grenades to North Mara. In an article posted on protestbarrick.net, a virtual hub of information for activists, Lissu is quoted saying that Barrick is, quote, on the warpath and repression is on, end quote. Lissu is an old rival of Barrick. A report posted on the company website accuses him of defaming their practices with slanderous claims that over 50 miners were murdered at another mine in Tanzania before Barrick purchased it. The report says point blank that Barrick does not condone repressive action. Meanwhile, operations have resumed at the North Mara gold mine in Tanzania. For Groundwire, this is David Koch.
Free open source software is increasingly being used, including by companies who try to make a profit off of it. That tension between not-for-profit and for-profit is leading to some problems, as John Zhang of CGSF reports.
Can you be sued for something that is free? The Free Software Foundation, which supports open source software, has filed a lawsuit against Cisco Systems. Free Software Foundation's licensing compliance engineer, Brett Smith, explains the situation.
So Cisco, over the past several years, in various products that they produce, has included software published by the Free Software Foundation. And that's fine. The license that we use for the software says that you're allowed to share it with others and change it. However, in order to make sure that everybody gets those rights, there are a couple conditions placed on people who do that. So for example, if you distribute the software, you also have to include a copy of the license and provide a copy of the source code for the program, the sort of human instructions that people can use to change the software, so that people who get the software from you will also be able to share it and to change it if they like. And unfortunately, Cisco was not meeting all of the obligations set forth in the license.
Smith states there are TVs, wireless routers, cell phones, and plenty of other everyday devices that run free software. There are 13 Cisco products listed as offenders, including their popular Linksys wireless router. Access to that software source code is critical.
Free software is important because as computers become more important to people's lives and people interact with the world around them more and more through technology, it's important that people be able to control that technology as well. If computers are controlled by someone else, whether it's because someone else has written some software and they don't let you change it, or because they want to implement draconian rules in the hardware, the computer is really obeying them more than it is obeying you, and it can be made to serve their interests rather than yours.
The Free Software Foundation's number one priority is for Cisco to meet the requirements of the license. Brett Smith explains why.
We're doing this really to protect users' rights. Like so many lawsuits are about, you know, one party feels wronged by another. And certainly, personally speaking, we would prefer to see Cisco fulfill the license obligations. But the real reason we went to court is to make sure that everyone has the right to share and change this software. It's not really about how they treat us. It's about how they treat their customers.
Negotiation with Cisco is in progress, and the expected time of resolution is still undetermined. The interview was done by Charlotte Bourne. Cisco was contacted, but they declined to comment. This is John Zhang, reporting for CJSF in Burnaby.
Rally in the valley for social justice now! Rally in the valley for social justice now!
Longtime activists Peter and Murray Corn had argued in front of the BC Human Rights Tribunal that the school curriculum in BC discriminated against same-sex couples. This resulted in the creation of the course Social Justice 12. Concern and disappointment came when the Abbotsford School Board decided to pull Social Justice 12 from the curriculum at W.J. Mowat Secondary this fall. Like many of her classmates, 16-year-old Chantel Gregg was very disappointed at the Abbotsford School Board's decision and decided to take action. She gained support from her classmates. Seeing the deep issues beneath the surface, the teens organized a social justice rally scheduled for December 6th. I spoke with executive director of the center in Vancouver, Jennifer Breakspear.
And then we're going to take this wonderful queer convoy all the way out to Abbotsford and join in a support of community, showing the folks in Abbotsford that they're not alone in this.
9 a.m. on Saturday morning, a bright yellow school bus drives towards Abbotsford with a boombox blasting away. The first song that plays, somewhat fittingly, is the U2 track One. Supporters on the bus are enthusiastic.
It's a statement. We're not coming in a car. We're not showing up in twos or threes. Hundreds at a time are going to pile off these buses. People care so much about this issue that they're willing to go support these teenagers and these teachers in their quest.
Rally in the valley for social justice now! Rally in the valley for social justice now!
Or just come for a walk, that's fine.
For social justice now!
Thank you all again so much for your courage, strength, and support in sending this powerful message to our city officials. Your voices will be heard. We support equality and diversity, human rights, and uncensored education. Thank you so much.
As the march ends on the grounds of the University of the Fraser Valley, the speaker portion of the rally begins. First, Martha Dow of UFV and the Institute for Safe Schools of BC.
In their belief statements, the Abbotsford School District talks about their responsibility and their commitment to provide a safe and caring environment for all, about a culture of trust and mutual respect. Clearly, they have decided that there is a segment of their community that does not warrant that sense of safety and respect. As an educator in this community, I feel privileged to be part of such a powerful political moment. As a lesbian and a mom, I am simply very, very thankful to all of you.
Thank you so much, Martha. Next, we have Rick Gunther, who's going to be speaking on behalf of the Abbotsford District Teachers Association.
Democracy needs you. Civil society needs you. You, the Rosa Parks of this bus we call the world, to take an informed stand and say, I will not give up my seat.
Next, from the rally, Tim Armstrong of the BC Federation of Labor.
So I ask you, where is Shirley Bond, the education minister? Premier Gordon Campbell. So far, the government has allowed the Abbotsford School Board to carry on with their discriminatory practices in violation of the agreement they signed.
The president of Vancouver Pride Society, Ken Coolin, he'd like to address you guys for a
bit. Thank you so much. Thank you for standing in the rain. My God, love you all. This is about change, and I'm looking at change right in front of me because 30 years ago, 17 people marched on the streets of Vancouver because they didn't want to be invisible anymore. And now, 30 years later, we have a pride parade that's over 500,000 strong because it's a mantra that I have, and that's, if not me, then who, and if not now, then when.
Next, we have Loretta Hughes, who is the director of the Fraser Valley Youth Society.
I would like to introduce you to the kid who started the big kerfuffle, and that is our Chantel Gregg.
After the rally, I spoke with several of the teens who founded and organized the Social Justice Rally, including Chantel and Chris, about what advice they would have for other youth.
It may be hard, but try not to let the people around you get to you, because if you deny yourself, like denying the fact that you are who you are, you're denying you.
Stand up for yourself. If you don't speak up, nothing's going to get done about it.
If you want acceptance, you're going to have to fight for it.
Acceptance never comes easy.
When I heard that there were going to be 3 buses from Vancouver, I was like,
thank you for coming.
Holy.
Thank you very
much. Thank
you.
Awesome. Absolutely.
I love your flag, by the way.
Thank you.
I could see it during the whole performance.
Oh, yeah. So awesome. So proud of you.
On the trip back to Vancouver, I spoke with several Lower Mainland supporters about their thoughts on the day.
I thought it was fantastic, of course, that teenagers, that students, that youth can motivate and can mobilize to get something like this started.
A lot of those young people were very, very well spoken, quite enunciated with their message. So hopefully they'll do well as long as we continue to support them.
The teens in Abbotsford continue to fight, and Peter and Murray Corrin, the couple who instigated the creation of Social Justice 12, have launched a human rights complaint against the Abbotsford Board of Education for withdrawing it. You've been listening to segments and interviews at the Rally for Social Justice in Abbotsford, British Columbia.
That was Kate Lerman of CJSF.
This month's Groundwire was produced at CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. Special thanks to Hershey and Lily of That Chinese Show for encouragement and pizza. Until next month, keep a song in your heart and your ear to the ground. I'm Adam Dugie for Groundwire.
This has been Groundwire, community news from across Canada. For more information on the show, visit us at groundwire.ncra.ca. This month's edition of Groundwire was produced at CJSF Radio. Coordination was by Frieda Worden and production was by Gavin Schaefer. You can visit our website at cjsf.ca. And remember, Groundwire features the voices of the community. That's you. To get involved, visit your local campus or community radio station.